going to get a little Walt Whitman-y today and compare the economy to a ship of state. And it's, you know, not bad. Sailing pretty well. We added a decent number of jobs last month. Unemployment dropped to its lowest level since 2007. I'm Lizzie O'Leary, and this is Marketplace Weekend, where the economy meets real life. Whitman wrote that poem I referenced when the country was in a moment of crisis. Now we are in one of profound change. And the whole economy as ship thing, well, there are some waves, some headwinds, some unhelpful currents. Wages still aren't what they should be. The number of people in the workforce is smaller. Gains are uneven, depending on who you are, where you live, and a whole number of other threads that we'll dig into today. Come join us and give us your feedback at marketplace.org, on our Facebook page, or on Twitter. We're at MarketplaceWKND. We're going to tug at some of those threads I mentioned when we start the show, as we generally do, with our particular way of looking at the news, with terms borrowed from the world of finance, long and short. Long as in betting on something, short as in betting against it. And this week, to go long and short, we have Tenzina Vega, who covers race and inequality for CNN, and Natalie Kitroeff, a reporter for the LA Times. Welcome to you both.
Welcome. Thank you.
Thank you.
It's nice to have you on. I want to dig in and have you guys throw out your long and shorts because they all kind of, well, except for one, knit together in a lot of the big things that the country has been talking about in the last few weeks. Tenzina, what are you long?
I'm long on, and actually discovered this for CNN Money about a week ago, I'm long on the working class and how we define the working class, particularly among people of color. What that looks like, why we only talk about it in one racial framework versus another.
Well, what do we think of when we think of the working class? I mean, that's such a term that gets thrown around a lot, but there doesn't seem to be a standard definition.
There isn't one, actually. I called almost every federal agency that I knew of to try and all the experts I knew of to define this. But basically, in terms of the economics of it, we're thinking people who are above the poverty line, but not maybe in the middle class. But I think with the narrative of the election, what we saw was there was this talk about the white working class and how the white working class are suffering. And I think all Americans economically, especially post-recession and post-housing crash and all this, are suffering. But the fact of the matter is that when we think about the working class, the image that comes to mind is the white guy going to the factory in the overalls, and that's that person has lost their job, right? And so the narrative around that is sort of this idea that, well, those jobs were taken away and those folks, it wasn't necessarily their fault. When we look at people of color, this is one of the economists that I spoke to, William Spriggs, said this. He said, you know, black and brown people are considered lazy, right? They're not considered workers. They're not considered part of this sort of working class. And so those are some of the things that I wanted to unpack and explore.
Natalie, you have spent some time writing about some of those factory jobs. When you talked to workers, do those narratives that Tenzina is describing resonate for you?
Definitely. You know, I spoke with workers, manufacturing workers in Pennsylvania mainly for a story that I recently did. And there's a sense that, you know, folks that are kind of working with their hands have lost a lot of ground. And when you're talking about that with workers, you know, race doesn't really come up. But when it shifts away from the work, there are divisions there that come out kind of immediately. You don't have to coax them out. It's kind of on the tip of everybody's tongue.
And one thing I thought was interesting, too, is that when we hear about black and brown workers in particular, there's this narrative, again, of the bootstraps mentality, right? Pull yourself by your bootstraps. That's what America's meant, you know, Americans do. But the fact of the matter is the economics for black and white Americans are very different.
Very different. Certainly, and particularly
gap.
Even more post-recession, the wealth
exactly.
gap was exacerbated.
Exactly. It's 13 times, on average, white families have 13 times the amount of wealth. And depending on what numbers you look at, the numbers I usually cite are about $143,000 on average wealth for white families compared to $13,000 for Latino families and $11,000 for black families. And so those numbers, I mean, people have said to me, are you sure? Is that, are you missing a zero? I'm like, no. Those are the numbers.
This actually ties in to, Natalie, your short. We get this announcement this week from Carrier that it's going to try to keep about 1,000 of the 1,400 jobs it was going to move to Mexico.
This
was a big point on the campaign trail, that they're going to keep them there. The president-elect has talked about this. But you are short Trump or any politician doing this on a bigger level. Tell me why.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, so this announcement is obviously, I just want to say, a huge victory for the 1,000 or so workers at this factory who will keep their jobs. And I talked to some of them recently. And, you know, I mean, this is not to downplay that. That is big for them. But in the long term, so, you know, what the details that we know now about this deal are that basically the state of Indiana paid Carrier to stay in the form of tax incentives. That's not a broad-scale manufacturing strategy. We've lost 5 million manufacturing jobs in this country since 2000. 1,000 jobs, first of all, here and there, are not going to put a dent in that massive loss that has really gripped this economy. And more to the point, Trump and kind of I would argue there's not anybody who can, on a broad scale, offer sort of incentives that would keep the jobs here. And part of the reason for that is that the nature of manufacturing in this country has radically transformed in recent years. So we're actually producing more than ever. Manufacturing output is at a record high, but we're doing that with fewer highly skilled workers. So you're looking at advanced manufacturing in this country. And the real challenge is, how do we train workers for the new types of jobs that are going to be on factory floors? Those aren't the kind of jobs that Tanzina was referring to, the kind of overall guy who's going in and working with his hands every day. You know, it's programming. It's being a technician. It's knowing how to work with robots that are increasingly doing the work that Americans were once doing on factory floors.
I agree 100%. And those jobs are also jobs that are going to be hard to come by unless you have the highly skilled, you know, worker ready to go, you know,
right,
who has that level of education. I think one thing that's also missing from this conversation about making America great is a raising of the minimum wage. We've been seeing a change in who does minimum wage jobs, whether it's retail, fast food. I mean, the next time you go to your fast food, you know, whatever fast food restaurant you go to, look at who's serving you your food. You know, it's probably someone who has a family. It's probably a senior citizen. It's probably someone.
This is not a teenager anymore.
This is not a 15-year-old who's doing this for summer work.
You just set up Natalie's long. So
yeah,
Natalie, hit it.
So yeah, I mean, I'm actually long on those workers, low-wage workers, getting a raise in 2017. I'm actually long on all Americans seeing a raise in 2017.
Because that's the thing that has lagged in economic data.
That's right. I mean, that's what we've seen over the last since the 80s is very, very incremental wage increases. And that kind of fuels a lot of the anger that we saw in the election. But broadly, economically, we're at a point where wages are starting to rise. Last month's jobs report showed a 2.8% increase in wages, which was the largest in 7 years. That's huge. Basically, the labor market is tightening, right? So employers are giving workers a raise. And it looks like we have the momentum to sustain that going forward. But on the low-wage workers who Tanzina was talking about, I mean, these folks are organized now, thanks to the Fight for 15 movement, which is the SEIU's kind of labor, it's a union-led movement, right? And the ultimate goal is to create a union. But for now, they just this week organized their largest protests ever, their largest sort of action ever. There are fears, especially here in California, where they're, you know, the Latino community is worried about their families getting deported. One organizer sort of described to me a situation where workers are fearing that everything that they fought for is going to slip away. And so, you know, they're more willing than ever to take to the streets. So if it's not the economy on its own, I have the sense that workers themselves are going to push for a raise in the form of, you know, a minimum wage hike broadly across the country in the coming year.
And undocumented workers in particular, I think, are probably some of the most vulnerable because they have no protections whatsoever. But also American workers who just, you know, can't keep pace. I mean, we keep thinking $15 an hour. I mean, think about how far $15 an hour goes in New York City. Not very.
Yeah.
Right. I mean, and then there's the other kind of component of this where you know, there's a lot of workers who now are put on part-time shifts, right? So the part-time work is surging in this country. And so then we're not even talking about 40 hours a week at 15, you know, or in many cases less than that. You're talking 20 hours a week. I mean, how do you raise a family or even take care of yourself with 20 hours at below $15 to get so little work at such a low pay? I think it's crippling to a lot of the workers that I've talked to.
Maybe I'll throw out a hopeful long here is that over the next couple of years, we can have a real national conversation on the nature of work and the future of work in America, because it seems long overdue.
I agree.
All right. I am going to turn this station wagon around big time on the highway. Tanzina, get us out of here with your short.
Oh, my God. Gilmore Girls? I have no idea. I never watched it. I don't know why it's a thing. I'm trying. It seems so out of left field to me. And I'm sorry. I don't get it. And
if
someone wants to explain, do you get it, Natalie?
No.
I don't get it.
I'm supposed to get it. Oh, you get it. Okay, Lizzie, please explain.
Okay, why? What is it?
It's nostalgia. The nostalgia business is booming.
That's true.
Look at the reboots and the remakes and everything else. The fact that all the things I wore in high school are back. Nostalgia is suddenly huge. And look, I get it. You're short on Gilmore Girls, but I am long on the underlying thing that it is tapping into. We want to create something that we felt when we were young.
I think you're right, particularly for Gen Xers. But yep. I just thought, no offense for the Gilmore Girls fans that are out there. I don't see it. And I don't know.
Tanzina Vega from CNN, Natalie Kitura from the LA Times. Thank you both so much.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Coming up this season on Codebreaker, do you think that this technology has saved you?
I'm probably alive because of it, but I don't know. I think it's probably saved me physically, but I think spiritually it probably bankrupted me.
We are back with a second season and a new question. Can it save us? We're asking this question of a different kind of technology every week. Subscribe now on iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts. Listen, decode, and decide.
Over the past few shows, we've been examining parts of President-elect Trump's potential policies. Now that he is naming people he would like to have in his cabinet, we're going to talk about what we can divine from his choices, about where our little economic ship might be headed. To do that, I am joined once again by our Washington Bureau Chief, Andrea Seabrook. Hi, Andrea.
Hey, Lizzie.
We've been waiting to have you back because now we have some names we can dig into Trump's likely nominees. They still have to go through Senate confirmation. To talk about policy and what we can divine from these names. So let's start with the marketplaceiest. That is, of course, the Treasury Department and Steven Mnuchin, former Goldman Sachs banker in other respects. How has this gone over, you know, over the course of the past week? And what do you see as the sort of coming road for him in Washington?
Well, I think this has been, you know, in many ways the most fascinating of Trump's picks so far. In part because he himself is just, he's kind of an enigma. I mean, he's a Wall Street guy. Everyone knows that.
Yep.
There is no question this guy knows how to sniff out a deal and make money off of it. When IndyMac was failing, he grabbed it, with help from the U.S. government, by the way, and then made a boatload of money selling it. Before that, he was at Goldman Sachs. He was one of the guys who did mortgage securities when that all started to happen. Now, I should say he wasn't involved with the subprime crisis in that way anyway. He was gone from Goldman before that came around. Now he's financing movies, like big Marvel movies and making
and
money.
And Mad Max.
Right. And making tons of money off of those. He has said several times that he has been a Republican forever, but the only Republican candidate other than Donald Trump that he has ever given money to was Mitt Romney, and he did give money to Al Gore and John Kerry and, you know, a bunch of other Democrats. And he worked for George Soros, the rights boogeyman, you know, the sort of liberal financier. He's really enigmatic. In a way, it's interesting politically because the signals there are that he might be the kind of person who can do this political trick that Donald Trump is attempting to do, which is both have fiscal priorities of Republicans and funding priorities of Democrats. And I speak of like the conventional priorities of those two groups. You know, he wants to pass stimulus and pump money into the economy at the same time that Trump wants to cut taxes. It's fascinating.
And that was something Mnuchin spoke about this week. He spoke about investing in infrastructure, which is something that raises the hackles of fiscal conservatives in the GOP. Is he going to get a welcome audience for that?
I think infrastructure is the kind of thing where big spending on projects that are essentially investments in the United States' infrastructure is so bipartisan. It's so desperately wanted by so many people that even the fiscal hawks, you know, the people who don't want to run up the budget or have problems with it, are going to be drowned out, really. I mean, there's no one who doesn't want infrastructure projects. There's this weird thing in the Republican Party where conservative doesn't mean what it used to mean. There are a lot of Republicans who don't really care how much spending you cut as long as you're cutting taxes. And that's absolutely counter to classic fiscal conservatism, where you're worried about the budget.
One thing we've heard from Trump supporters this week is that this is not exactly, when we're talking about Mnuchin, a drain-the-swamp pick.
No.
And we mentioned these are nominees. Do you see a backlash that could derail either the Mnuchin nomination or any of the other picks that have been thrown out there? After all, Senate confirmation is a very real thing. Not everybody just slides in with their first choice of cabinet members.
That's true. Although there is a tradition of generally allowing presidents, you know, it's not like a Supreme Court nomination where, you know, they're fighting tooth and claw. But that said, there are plenty of nominees over time that have sort of tucked their tail between their legs and walked. It's not like they get voted down. They generally withdraw from a process if things don't go well.
Yeah, I think of Bill Clinton's first three, I believe, attorney general nominees.
I mean, like, you know, things come up. You know, skeletons come out of closets. People go away. Or what's interesting with Trump's nominees is that I don't see anyone on the horizon yet or any reason that they wouldn't necessarily be confirmed by the Senate, but I can see a lot of interesting confirmation hearings and a lot of names and pasts dragged through the mud. You know, with Mnuchin specifically, he made a boatload of money off of the housing crisis. And one of the ways that he did that was by buying IndyMac cheap when it was failing and then foreclosing on mortgages. I mean, it's not just that he took a business opportunity, like he was one of the owners when IndyMac was foreclosing on mortgages. And by the way, that company, which is now called One West, is under investigation for that very period by the U.S. government for lending practices and whether it was being discriminatory and in those practices. So we get to this same place with almost every nominee and with, frankly, Trump himself, where you have to ask, okay, the possibilities for conflict of interest are so gigantic that those nomination hearings that'll come up in the Senate, they're going to be serious fireworks over the Capitol.
And you'll be watching them. Andrea Seabrook, our Washington bureau chief, thank you very much.
Thank you.
The governor of North Dakota said this week that he's trying to find a solution to the standoff over the Dakota Access Pipeline, a nearly $3.8 billion energy project. For months now, protesters at the Standing Rock Reservation in North Dakota have been clashing with law enforcement and the company Energy Transfer Partners over plans to run part of the oil pipeline near the Standing Rock Reservation and its water source. There are a lot of different threads in this story. You've probably seen it on social media. To pull them apart, we have Dan Gunderson. He is a correspondent at NPR News, part of our APM family. Thanks for coming on.
Oh, you're welcome.
Can you give us a sense of what the scene is like at Standing Rock now? I understand it's getting really cold out there.
It is, although it's not as cold as a typical winter in North Dakota. Temperatures so far have been warmer than normal, although there was a blizzard that rolled in and changed conditions quite a bit this week. I'm sitting at the camp right now looking out over a sea of tents and dozens of traditional teepees and some wood structures that have been recently built to withstand the harsh North Dakota winters. All sorts of things that people are using to stay warm, including a public transit bus down here with a stovepipe sticking out the window.
And I understand that the protesters are saying they are not giving up. Can you, for people who haven't been following this closely, kind of give us the quick sketch of what they are protesting?
Well, they're protesting a pipeline called the Dakota Access Pipeline that is designed to move oil from the Bakken oil fields in North Dakota to Illinois. And the importance of that is there's a hub in Illinois which then allows that oil to move to refineries in the Gulf Coast. And that's important for the people who are producing the oil in North Dakota. Now, this pipeline crosses just north of the Standing Rock Reservation. And the point of contention here is the Missouri River. The river is actually dammed to make a reservoir here called Lake Oahee. And the plan is to tunnel under that lake to put the pipe in place. And that's pretty much all that remains to make this pipeline complete. And that's what the protest is about. And the Standing Rock Tribal Council has said from the beginning they opposed this pipeline, and they were concerned about a potential leak which would affect their water supply, which is the Missouri River. And they were also concerned about destruction of sacred sites that are all over the landscape here.
Energy Transfer Partners, which owns this pipeline, has said it would cost approximately $3.8 billion. Is there any sense that they might budge and or reroute?
Well, they have said that they will not reroute, that this pipeline is going to be built. They're obviously still waiting. They need a permit from the Army Corps of Engineers to make that tunnel under the river, under Lake Oahee, to get the pipe through. And originally they had that permit back in July, and then the Corps of Engineers said, well, wait a minute, we're going to revisit this and take a look. We need to do a little more examination of this and consult with the tribe more on this. And so we're still waiting for the Corps to make a decision on what will happen with that permit.
One of the issues we've seen surrounding pipeline construction across the country over the last few years is land ownership issues. How common is it for a pipeline to go across native land or near sovereign native land?
Well, that's what makes this a really complicated issue, because we have treaties involved here. For example, the pipeline goes just north of land, which is the Standing Rock Reservation. But tribal officials say it's crossing treaty land, which they believe they still have the rights to. This is a treaty of Fort Laramie from 1851, which gave a large area of land to the Sioux Nation here. And they say they still have the rights to that land. And so that's part of the issue here. A lot of this land is officially in private ownership, or some of the land in question is owned by the Army Corps of Engineers. But tribal officials say, hey, this treaty has never been abrogated, and so this treaty still gives us control over this land.
Does anything change as far as either the protesters or the company is concerned with a change of presidential administrations that is going to happen in January?
Well, I guess we'll have to wait and see. Obviously, President-elect Trump has said that he's very supportive of the oil industry and production in the U.S., I know that after the election, there was some fear expressed here at the camp about what that might mean. There was a lot of hope that President Obama would do something here and step in and take some action. And there's been some disappointment expressed here that he has not done that. They felt perhaps they would get a reprieve from President Obama at some point.
Are there other things that you have seen in your reporting there that you think are not getting out widely that people who are listening to this should know?
Well, it's a very challenging story. It's a very remote location. It's a difficult area to get to and to cover. Cell phone signals are often very spotty. We have these competing narratives coming out from energy transfer partners, from law enforcement, sort of painting these protesters as, you know, violent and dangerous. And when you spend time at the camp, you realize, you know, the message here is that it's a peaceful, prayerful protest. And for the most part, most of the people that you talk to here are committed to a peaceful protest. There are some people here who feel that a more aggressive approach is needed. And so you have these competing narratives playing out on social media, and it can be very challenging, I think, for people to get a real sense of what is happening here. Most of the time, this is a very peaceful place. People are helping each other. They're building structures together. You have strangers working together who've never met each other before. So in many ways, it's a pretty amazing place that sprung up here on the prairie in North Dakota, but it's also a very complicated situation.
Dan Gunderson, within the APM family from NPR News, thank you so much for talking with us.
You're welcome, Lizzie.
Day at the office, or maybe you had an experience that totally changed your perspective. We've all been there, and that is why we have the Marketplace Quiz. It's our chance to talk with people in the spotlight about work, money, and the lessons they've learned. This week, an indie rock band stops by.
Hi, this is Taylor.
And this is Kelsey, and we're in Local Natives.
Kels, what is something everyone should own, no matter what the cost?
I think a dog.
I knew you were going to say dog. I don't even know why you thought for that long, how you pretended to think for that long.
I just got my dog, as you know, a year and a half ago, and I think I was talking to our bus driver about it.
Bet you were.
To Joe. Mm-hmm. Yeah, because he has a dog at home, and he's like, "There's this, you know, it doesn't matter who you are or what you've done in your life. You come home, and that dog loves you so much. And
no matter who you've betrayed,
no matter
and wronged,
all the horrible things you've done in your life, horrible deeds. Right, right. That dog is going to love
you. That dog loves you.
And I think there's an emotional benefit to having that kind of companionship, that kind of unconditional love, you know, from an animal. So I think I definitely see the value in having a dog. What is the hardest part about your job that nobody knows?
The hardest part about being a musician is the travel, but more specifically the health aspect of traveling. So people might actually know that or think that, like, it can be tough to live out of a suitcase or be city to city, but what's really hard is your schedule gets ultra turned around. So you finish a show, you know, you kind of go on at maybe 9:30, come off at 11, then your endorphins are super high and spiked, so it takes a really long time to wind down, and you're going to have to eat a meal super late, so an ultra early bedtime is 2 a.m. You end up slipping till 3, maybe 4 a.m. going to sleep, and the sleep that you're getting is not great. So I think the biggest struggle about it is just staying really healthy, eating really well, getting regular sleep. Just simply that can be pretty tough.
Yeah. You can't really sleep until the bus gets to the next city and it's stopped. So then you end up getting your best sleep from like 9 a.m. to like noon.
Well, that's horrible. I've been sleeping pretty well on this tour, so I don't even know how you're alive.
Oh yeah. So that's how it is for me.
If that's the case. That's truly horrendous.
Yep.
Kelsey, what is something you've bought but now completely regret buying?
I would say when I was a freshman in college, I spent $150 on a Ninja blending system thing. Uh-huh. And I had like no money, and I never used it.
Yeah, but now you can just eat smoothies cheaply.
Maybe if I even knew where it was.
You just bought it, never used it.
Never used it, and then I can't even tell you where it is at this moment. So
that should carry over when on our last tour, the Hummingbird tour, we tried to buy a huge juicer. I mean, I was pushing the juicer push, and then nobody was really in charge of packing up and cleaning it up. So we lost vital pieces to it three times, and we bought it three times over. So
that's a group regret. Okay, here's the last question, Taylor. What advice do you wish someone gave you when you started your career?
The advice I wish that I had received is to, I think, not hold on so tightly to every idea that you have along the way. And I think that could be creatively, or it could be kind of in business and in business decisions or relationships as well. I think it's taken me a while and us as a band a while to learn that when you kind of more try to tap into a flow of what's working really well and move quickly, that tends to just make us feel a lot more productive and also just work from a really happy place. I think that's something that took quite a while to kind of learn, to try to be a little bit right. more nimble and move
yeah.
quickly.
Because I think, you know, ideas kind of show their worth over time. And I think if something's really worth it, they end up kind of rearing their heads later. So you don't have to, yeah, freak out as much trying to make something work.
Local Native's album Sunlit Youth is out now. We like to do the numbers here at Marketplace, so let's dig into a couple of them with our own Cerise Castle and Aditi Bandlamudi as they bring us some of this week's news by the numbers. Take it away, Cerise.
Thanks, Lizzie. Our first number is
1.2 million.
That's how many barrels of oil OPEC, the Organization of Petroleum Exporting Countries, is cutting from daily production.
That's 1% of global oil production.
And since the agreement was announced, oil prices have been rising. $2.
That's how much your old mattress is worth to a recycling company like Goodwill Industries in Duluth, Minnesota.
That's 10 cents a pound for the foam, 4 cents a pound for the cotton, and 3 cents a pound for the quilted topper.
The real money is in the springs, which get crushed into 80-pound steel bricks. 6.
That's how many U.S. airlines will be flying to Cuba in 2017, when Alaska Airlines joins the five others offering flights to Havana.
After 50 years without commercial travel between the U.S. and Cuba, these flights are historic.
But making a profit might be tricky. With 20 flights a day from the U.S. to Havana, there's a lot of competition, and fares are very low.
For now.
We talked about oil and drinking water earlier in the show. President-elect Trump says he wants more oil and gas production. That could mean more fracking, where water and chemicals are pumped down wells to fracture rock and release oil and gas. That's led to worries about pollution in drinking water. But last year, the EPA, under President Obama, gave fracking a green light. A long-awaited study of fracking safety basically said no big deal. A lot of scientists were surprised, and the public debate pretty much went away. But Marketplace has learned that the EPA's no big deal headline message was a last-minute change, one that raises questions about manipulation and politicization of scientific research. In a collaboration with the investigative unit APM Reports, here's Marketplace's Scott Tong of our sustainability desk.
The EPA study came as a divided America was telling itself two different stories about fracking. That is, shooting water underground to break up rock and release the oil and gas inside. One story is of innovation and energy abundance, fracking re-energizing the old energy economies in Texas and North Dakota and Pennsylvania. The other story is about the risk that fracking contaminates water supplies, leading New York in the U.S. and many other countries to ban fracking. Into this high-stakes debate came the EPA study, 5 years in the making, with an unexpected conclusion. Here's Deputy Assistant Administrator Tom Burke announcing those preliminary findings last year.
Hydraulic fracturing activities in the United States are carried out in a way that has not led to widespread systemic impacts on drinking water resources.
No widespread systemic impacts.
According to the feds, there is no evidence fracking has had...
Industry jumped on this positive conclusion. A finding suspicious of fracking would have been a huge roadblock. Instead, the oil and gas companies trumpeted the EPA's words, especially in states that are still debating fracking, including Maryland.
The government has concluded that hydraulic fracturing, or fracking, does not do widespread harm to drinking water.
Except Marketplace and APM reports have learned the controversial phrase was inserted very late in the process. We obtained several internal draft versions of the study's press release and its executive summary. That is the abridged version that most people, including most journalists, actually read. The documents were confirmed independently by people with knowledge of the study. The draft press release, just one day before going public, had a more cautionary tone. Its focus, quote, study shows potential vulnerabilities. But by the next day, the focus had changed to no widespread impact. In the executive summary, that phrase was put in with just 5 weeks to go in a five-year study. That was right around the time EPA and White House officials met to discuss messaging for the study, according to internal emails. So, who made the changes?
I would highly doubt that the groundwater scientists who were involved in a technical sense wrote that statement.
Dominic DiGiulio is a former EPA research scientist. He says there's not enough data for such a blanket statement. Modern fracking is pretty new, and most data belong to companies that don't have to share it. We asked the EPA about the late edits. Tom Burke, who announced the study, agreed to an interview but then declined. EPA Administrator Gina McCarthy also didn't speak with us. The agency emailed a statement, which reads in part, EPA is working to finalize the assessment to be responsive to the comments received. The study's final version is still pending. Here's where we have to be very straight with you. Because EPA leaders did not talk to us, we don't know who made the late changes or why. We did speak to 13 current and former agency scientists with knowledge of the study. Some described the no widespread impacts line as head-scratching, surprising, and bizarre. Others are more critical, quote, irresponsible, and overreach. Either way, that line, again, no widespread systemic impacts, was called into question after its release by the EPA's own science advisors. Some called it a value statement instead of a scientific one. University of Iowa environmental scientist Peter Thorne chairs the advisory board.
We suggested that they provide a definition of systemic, a definition of widespread, and then provide quantitative data to support the conclusion, to put that kind of scientific rigor behind a statement as broad as that.
The advisors also said that the executive summary's top-line findings were inconsistent with the actual study. Earth system scientist Rob Jackson of Stanford, author of several fracking papers, calls it a mismatch.
The headline, saying no widespread systemic influence, and yet a body of the report that documented a lot of cases of things that could have been done better. And now that mismatch makes a little bit more sense, to be quite frank, as we hear about the change in the message towards the end.
To him, the late edit gave regulators what he calls political cover to go easy on industry.
It's not Watergate, but it completely alters the take-home message of the report. It also raises lots of questions. Who influenced the final conclusions? Did they alter the content of the report in any way? We'll probably never know.
And he wonders if this is connected to three EPA retreats from high-profile fracking contamination investigations in 2012 in Pennsylvania, Wyoming, and Texas. The EPA excluded data from those places in its study, but the agency advisors suggested it reconsider. What's clear is the EPA was called in to settle a long-standing dispute, and it appeared to vindicate and to absolve fracking, says longtime energy regulatory observer Kevin Book. His D.C. firm, Clearview Energy Partners, provides research to oil and gas investors.
That's a big deal. That reinforces the sense that there's nothing to see here, folks. Move on. The idea that the EPA is above regional bias gives it an additional power to an EPA absolution of a technology.
A technology that has helped swamp the U.S. with ultra-cheap natural gas, that has put a number of coal and natural gas plants out of business, and it's helped crash the global price of crude oil. There's a lot riding on North American fracking, and Washington knows it, says ex-EPA scientist Dominic DiGiulio.
It's a very powerful industry, of course, and there's a lot of pressure that's put on EPA to not have findings that would cause financial harm to that industry. The wall between politics and science is not completely solid, you know, at times.
And the next administration is even more overtly pro-oil and gas, notes Michael Halpern at the nonprofit Union of Concerned Scientists.
We're really concerned that science that is critical to protecting public health and safety will be more vulnerable to suppression or spin.
For all the questions about EPA messaging, here are a few things the study actually found. Fracking chemicals sloshing around in pits and transported by trucks can induce spill and leach into the ground. Some fracking goes straight into drinking water resources, which in some cases are actually mixed in with the oil and gas. And wells can be poorly constructed. About 3% of the time, the study found, wells lacked outer cement to protect aquifers from contamination. Now, here's where the science gets tricky. The overall pollution instances were low, which could suggest fracking is safe, or that there's not enough good data.
And fundamentally, there aren't strong conclusions from this.
George Gray is professor of risk assessment at George Washington University. He's former head of the EPA research office under President George W. Bush.
We're not seeing a lot of problems, but then it could be because we're not looking closely enough. Right there, you know, choosing which one of those to focus on is going to put a different spin to the way that you look at that report.
Again, the EPA study is not over. The final version could drop the line about no widespread systemic impacts after criticism from its own advisors. And that press release with a controversial line, it was removed from the fracking study's main website a couple months after it came out, when EPA media staffers said the release was bumped to the archives to accommodate a newer link. Another said the press release didn't get enough attention. In Washington, I'm Scott Tong for Marketplace.
If your office is anything like our office, someone is probably sneezing, spreading that cold that's going around. And it seems like when one person at work gets sick, it's only a matter of time before everyone does. One potential reason why is the actual office. Most of the buildings we work in are completely sealed off from the outside world. That helps save on heating and cooling costs, but it can also mean that tiny little microorganisms are just endlessly circulating around you. To discuss the office microbiome, we've got Zoe Schlanger, science contributor at Wired, who wrote about this. I asked her if we were basically sitting in a giant bowl of germs.
Absolutely. The second you walk into your office or literally any room, you're just bathed in microbes that aren't yours continuously.
Can you tell me what a microbiome is? Because that's something that I feel like gets tossed around a lot. I don't exactly know what it means.
Yeah, this past year has been, we've heard so much hype about the human microbiome, which is all of the tiny little single-celled creatures that live in your gut, in your genitals, in your mouth, all over your skin. And it turns out they play a huge role in our health, and we're still trying to figure out what it is. It's basically an alien planet right now to scientists. We're only understanding small aspects of how it affects your immune system and which microbes are good and which are bad. But the microbiome, it turns out, extends way beyond your body. We walk around in a cloud of microbes every day, and they're in your building, too. Every surface you touch, every cubic foot of air you breathe in, it's full of these germs.
How is your office microbiome different than the one in your house, let's say?
Typically, it'll have a lot more human microbes swimming around because you don't have as many people in your house. But also, they're designed, typically, if you work in an office building with many floors, the ventilation is determining how many microbes and which microbes you're around in. So it'll be a higher content of artificial microbes than it would be in your house, typically.
So you and I are actually sitting under a vent in this studio that's coming down from another floor. What is falling on us that we can't see?
Probably the microbes of whoever is in the office above you. Have you ever gone to check them out and see how healthy they look?
I guess we should do that.
But also just anything else that's been sitting in the ducts, for example, or any of the dust that's just been accumulating. Typically, if you come into your office on a Monday, the ventilation system's been off all weekend, and you're probably getting a lot more artificial dust that you're breathing in coming in through these vents.
So if someone is listening to this right now, They want to know, what is this doing to me?
The interesting part is that we know very little. This is the first year, really, that researchers are trying to determine what is happening and what these things might be doing to us. There's a million experiments going on right now, papers coming out probably next year that'll help us understand things like, if you touch your water cooler, how many microbes are actually crawling into your own microbiome and transferring? We don't know that yet. Things like, if your windows don't open in your office, are you more likely to get sick because you're not intermingling with some of the beneficial outdoor microbes as much? All things we don't know that are hugely affecting our health, especially in places like hospitals.
So if they are affecting our health, but we're sort of still trying to understand that, are there things you can do now to avoid getting sick?
I think opening a window if you can. Now, this is always a tricky thing because there's lots and lots of research that says children, for example, who grow up in farms where they're constantly contacting animals and they have contact with dirt have a much lower rate of immune disorders or things like asthma. And so researchers are tentatively saying more interaction with outside air is better. But then you have to wonder, is there a truck idling outside your window?
Right.
We don't know.
Like if you and I were to walk out of the studio and throw open a window onto Third Avenue, would that be good, bad? Do we know?
It's completely up in the air right now. My guess would be probably not the greatest. I mean, all the city buses and everything. But maybe better than just constantly breathing in the recirculating air, which is a very new phenomenon. Humans have only been living in these tight buildings for maybe the last two generations at most. So we really don't know what it means to live in a sealed environment.
When we think about a sealed environment and when we think about our microbiome, are there things that this research is informing in the way design works and people use building materials and all the stuff that could change for the next generation or a few generations from now?
Absolutely. I think we're going to see this come up a lot more in the next few years. There's actually a startup in San Francisco that's still in stealth mode, so they won't let me talk about them. But they're specifically figuring out how to design offices to circulate microbes in such a way that might help the health of the people who live or work in the office. People are really trying to figure out how to be intentional about design, how to design vents in a certain way, how to somehow bring in beneficial outdoor microbes, how to position houseplants so that their beneficial microbes are circulating more. That is one thing you can do for your health. Have more plants.
Have more plants. Okay, good. We have seen big trends in office design rise and fall. People had offices with doors that closed. Then open plan offices came into vogue. Then certain kinds of lighting came into vogue. Do you think it's possible that thinking about the physical health of an office is the next thing that architects and designers are going to be working with?
I think absolutely. There's been a trend towards making our buildings more sealed off from the outside because it's more energy efficient. So as all these cities are trying to be more wary of climate change, use less energy, they're sealing offices off more, which hypothetically could be bad for our health. We don't quite have those conclusions yet. But now that we're starting to understand that, I think people will be trying to restructure offices so that they have more flow and can be better for one's health.
What are the top few things that scientists are studying to say, hey, like this might not be a great idea?
So there's this new trend of putting antimicrobial agents into house paint and linoleum flooring and all kinds of things you'd use as building materials. And researchers are just starting to be like, hold on a minute. Why are we putting things that will generate potentially more antibiotic-resistant genes in our dust that we're all breathing in every day? So there's this big debate now, like building materials kind of very unregulated. No one's really looking out for it. And all these paints that put antimicrobials in them are now labeling themselves as better for your health, but we really have no idea whether or not that's true, and people are suggesting it might be the opposite.
This seems to sort of mirror the debate about whether you use antibacterial soap on your hands.
Exactly. The FDA banned triclosan this year, which is one of the big antimicrobial agents in soap, because they couldn't find any conclusions that said they actually improved one's health, and there's too many things that are suggesting it could disrupt our hormone cycles or do other slightly malicious things to our health. And now nobody's doing anything about it in walling, for example. There's no regulations on that.
So if I get to the end of a long week in the office, should I just go outside and roll around in the dirt?
I think that'd be a great idea. Or just stick your face in your puppy, if you have one, or your cat. They'll transfer lots of beneficial microbes your way, apparently.
Zoe Schlanger is a science contributor at Wired Magazine. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Lizzie.
And that's our show for this week. Next week, we're going to continue exploring the policies and appointments of President-elect Trump. What would you like to know? Visit us at marketplace.org, our Facebook page, or hit us up on Twitter. We're at Marketplace WKND. Marketplace Weekend is produced by Eliza Mills, Haley Hirschman, and Cerise Castle. Dan Semitovich is our senior producer. Jake Gorski and Chris Clark are our engineers. Our theme music is composed by Naren Rao. Sitara Nieves is Marketplace's executive producer. Deborah Clark is our vice president. I'm Lizzie O'Leary. Thanks for listening. This is APM.